My conversation with Dr. Delaney touched on a number of interesting research areas in triple-negative breast cancer, and I met with Dr. Tiffany Traina to learn more about another area that she is very involved with, specifically the use of antiandrogens. And to help illustrate the potential of this approach, she discussed a patient from her practice.
So she presented to me at the time of her metastatic disease in the fall of 2013. And so her treating oncologist back in 2007, you know, rightly so, gave an attempt at adjuvant chemotherapy for what seemed to be a poorly differentiated triple negative breast cancer. And she indicated, as did the oncologist, that she had a terrible time tolerating her adjuvant chemotherapy and just was not interested in continuing any further and discontinued after just two cycles. So she presented to me fall of 2013 when her local doc had performed a chest x-ray for a mild cough. And that's what identified this large mass that ultimately was biopsied and confirmed recurrent triple negative breast cancer.
And where else did she have disease, and what was her sort of clinical status at that point?
So primarily large pulmonary metastases. She did have some bone lesions. She was asymptomatic from those. And there was a liver lesion, again, with normal transaminases. And her functional status was quite good. The cough, although present, was really mild and had actually improved since the time of the original chest x-ray. So although there was a greater than 2-centimeter mass there and some smaller nodules, she was minimally symptomatic from the burden of her disease.
So maybe we can take a step back, and I'm curious if there's anything new in terms of the biology of triple negative disease, particularly the connection to BRCA mutations and BRCA-like functioning.
Sure. So I think we're recognizing that triple negative breast cancer is really a heterogeneous disease. And the Lehman data has shown that at the molecular level that you can subdivide out triple negative into subtypes that seem to have a basal-like profile. And perhaps those are the ones that may best respond to platinum-based therapies. That would be a reasonable hypothesis. And there are others that have more immune markers. And one that is near and dear to my heart is a subset termed luminal AR, which seems to be driven by an endocrine profile and the androgen receptor. And so there clearly is heterogeneity. One of the things that we've been trying to sort out is there an easy clinical picture to help you try to identify who are the women that may have that androgen-driven triple-negative breast cancer?
So actually, I'm not sure I heard that before. So are you saying that these androgen receptor positive triple negative tumors are luminal genetically?
Exactly that. So if you look at their gene expression profile, those tumors would cluster with your luminal A and even your luminal B tumors. They have what looks like a very endocrine-driven profile to them. Yet, at the immunohistochemical level, they are truly estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor negative. And when we've looked at what makes them unique, they have overexpression of the androgen receptor at the gene level and then also confirmed at the protein level.
And about what percent of triple negative disease, first of all, is luminal?
Great question. So this would depend on the data set that you're looking at. So there are retrospective data sets that have ranged anywhere from about 15% up as high as about 50%. I think that reflects differences in testing. There is no standard of care commercially available immunohistochemical test for us to be screening for the status of the androgen receptor. In prospective clinical trials, we've now had two phase two prospective studies looking at AR-positive triple-negative breast cancer. One was TBCRC11, and that was conducted with bicalutamide, the oral AR antagonist. The prospective screening there found about 12% of women with triple-negative breast cancer were AR-positive. More recently, what we presented at ASCO was phase two data of enzalutamide in patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer screened for AR status. And there, with setting the threshold of AR of any staining, so greater than 0%, 79% of triple-negative breast cancer patients had some degree of AR staining. If we set the threshold at 10% or greater, 55% of triple negative cases were AR positive.
How does the degree of AR positivity compare to, for example, what you see with prostate cancer?
It's highly expressed in prostate cancer.
Much more than these?
More than we would expect in breast. But part of the challenge in developing a paired diagnostic assay is getting the testing just right. You see, in the first study, the bicalutamide study, the expression was around 12%. The proportion was about 12% of all screened. But that was using methods that had been optimized in prostate tissue. The second study, the enzalutamide trial, worked to really optimize AR testing at the immunohistochemical level in breast tissue. And I think altered and optimized that sensitivity. So they had a higher positivity rate. But another interesting point in that trial was it may not be AR by IHC that is most predictive of benefit. We saw people with low AR expression derive benefit from enzalutamide. And so in a correlative study, as part of that prospective trial, gene expression profiles as a biomarker to predict response were developed.
And what was the methodology of the gene expression profiling?
So not all of that data has been released just yet. Joel Parker presented some of the original work in a poster session at ASCO, and we anticipate more coming this year, hopefully at San Antonio. But tissue was collected on all patients that were screened on study. So in the development of that biomarker, RNA was extracted and expression profiles conducted. There were tumors that were AR zero as well as AR positive through the whole spectrum of expression. And that was the method used in developing a potential biomarker that then was validated in other data sets.
Interesting. You know, this thing about the luminal subtyping in these patients, you know, honestly, to some extent, I never exactly have followed the meaning of the subtypes. You know, like St. Galen really gets into this, and it seems like Europeans do, you know. But in terms of just practically what it means, I'm not sure I really understand, other than, yeah, they group together genetically, so I guess they're similar. I can't seem to get too far beyond that. Maybe you can help me.
I think for day-to-day, it doesn't necessarily have immediate implications. But it is very interesting and sort of confirming what we do see in practice, that not all patients with triple negative breast cancer behave the same way. So we've had women who are young develop a triple negative breast cancer and quickly after their adjuvant therapy, in a matter of months or within a year, have developed metastatic disease and die rapidly with this explosive course. But then, as the woman that I alluded to earlier that I've been caring for, her diagnosis was back in 2007, and she had a six-year disease-free interval before a recurrence. That is confirmed triple-negative breast cancer, but the feeling is that biology is not the same as what our young woman with a really short disease-free interval experienced.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I noticed she was a late recurrer, and before I saw, you know, what happened to her, I was thinking, oh, that is unusual. You know, reminds you more of ER-positive disease.
Exactly. And I think that's the takeaway message for clinical practice right now in terms of asking how do we apply these gene expression profiles. It's to recognize that there are potentially different drivers within triple negative breast cancer, within the heterogeneity that's there. And that is hypothesis generating for developing clinical trials to target the different biomarkers that might be there. In practice yet, I don't think that we are quite there outside of a clinical trial to say, based on a gene expression profile, we know what treatment to choose next.
So before we get on with this patient, you mentioned the work that you've done and the work was presented at ASCO with enzalutamide. Can you talk a little bit more about the quality of the responses that are seen? Are they clinically meaningful? How long do they last?
Sure. Terrific question. So this study, the enzalutamide trial, was the first time we've seen RECIST confirmed responses, including a patient with a complete response as a result of an anti-androgen in triple negative breast cancer. So there are clear responses with symptom improvement, resolution of pleural effusions, complete radiographic response. The duration of response is quite long. So one endpoint of that trial was a clinical benefit rate at 24 weeks. To suggest that patients were able to have at least stable disease for 6 months with a simple daily oral endocrine option, whereas otherwise we would be comparing this to standard of care cytotoxics like taxanes or platinums, it's extremely well tolerated and helping to really control disease.
So one thing that we've heard from the prostate cancer people about enzalutamide in particular, it's kind of hard to exactly tease out, but I keep hearing about fatigue. Do you see that?
So we see fatigue almost across the board with our therapies and with our women just faced with metastatic breast cancer. So yes, fatigue was one of the adverse events that we noticed on the trial, but not in remarkable degree. We did not see any seizure activity, which was also a concern with that drug in prostate cancer, but there were no events there. We did see people describe a bit of fogginess or cognitive slowing, and that was able to be managed at times simply just switching the dosing of the drug from morning dosing to evening dosing. And it was more something noted when patients came off the drug. They said, oh, I feel a little bit clearer than before. So it is a very challenging term even to describe what it is that they were feeling. And maybe that's some of the fatigue that was attributed in men. We've had some of my patients describe it as a bit of a foggy feeling.
Yeah, that's true. I was just speaking actually with Dan Petrilak from Yale about this. And he was, you know, as you say, patients with metastatic disease often have fatigue. It's kind of hard to tease it out, but there's something subjectively that seems to be happening. I take it that indirectly, it looks like clinically that enzalutamide is more effective than bicalutamide?
Well, I think this was not a head-to-head study. Preclinically, enzalutamide is more potent than bicalutamide, and we have that superiority data from the prostate cancer literature. We don't exactly have that in breast cancer. However, it was this enzalutamide trial that was the first to ever show both confirmed partial and complete responses as a result of antiandrogen therapy. We did not see that on TBCRC11 with bicalutamide.
This strategy, you know, we hear now, you know, lung cancer, for example, subsets of 1% of the disease and less that they're developing treatments for. Globally, what fraction of metastatic breast cancer you think would fall into this category? Is it enough to really have a meaningful effect on the disease?
I think within triple-negative breast cancers, triple-negative breast cancer accounts for probably about 20% of all breast cancer. There's heterogeneity within there, but based on the enzalutamide prospective screening, as many as 55% of triple-negative cases had some degree of AR expression. So I think it is a meaningful subset to be able to offer an effective therapy in a portion of patients with triple-negative breast cancer that's highly well-tolerated and following a paradigm not unlike estrogen-driven breast cancer, where we start with sequential endocrine therapies before we need to move on to chemotherapy. That would be a quality of life win for our patients with triple-negative disease. Separate from triple-negative breast cancer, there is high co-expression of androgen receptor with estrogen receptor. And in ER-positive breast cancer, it's as high as 80% co-expression. And preclinically, we have some neat evidence that as resistance to estrogen-targeted therapies develops, there is more dependence on androgen receptor signaling. And so there may be a role for antiandrogens in breast cancers that are resistant to anti-estrogen therapy. And that's something going on in clinical trials right now.
Have patients been studied with ER-positive disease clinically with antiandrogens and have responses been seen?
So there is an ongoing trial of enzalutamide in patients with metastatic ER-positive breast cancer where there's a randomization to exemestane with placebo or exemestane with enzalutamide. That trial is ongoing, and we anticipate results in this year, at least some first-stage results.
Any discussions about combining antiandrogens with other agents? And of course, in ER-positive disease, we're seeing CDK inhibitors like palbociclib, mTOR inhibitors, everolimus. What about that strategy with antiandrogens?
Yep, absolutely. So because the subtype has that luminal profile, we think that some of those other mechanisms of resistance may also be in play. There is a multi-center trial going on through the Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium looking at enzalutamide with a PI3 kinase inhibitor in investigation. There is a trial opening up shortly looking at an AR antagonist in combination with palbociclib. That's just a small phase 2 study that Sloan Kettering will have. So there are absolutely thoughts of looking at what other combined targeted therapies can help the anti-androgen work better and overcome resistance.
So your 75-year-old lady seems like she had a pretty bad experience with chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting. Now she has metastatic disease. I'm guessing she wasn't too excited about getting chemotherapy at that point. What happened with her?
Exactly right. So it would take a lot of convincing to get her to use systemic chemotherapy. And so we explored clinical trials right at the bat. That's in the context of screening for a clinical trial. We found her tumor to be AR 90% positive and had the availability of that enzalutamide trial as an option for her. It would be certainly appropriate also to be thinking about immunotherapy trials and other novel targeted therapies here, but there was no way she was interested in taking chemotherapy.
What exactly happened when she got the, I see she got dose-dense AC. What happened that was so difficult for her?
So she wasn't under my care then, but it was a constellation of profound fatigue and really anhedonia, decreased appetite. And with just two cycles, it was intolerable to her. Even with what sounds like excellent supportive management with available technologies during her treatment, she was not interested.
So she had AR 90%. You put her on the trial?
Right. So she was happy to try a clinical trial with enzalutamide and has tolerated it quite well. And she's had stable disease for about 15 months now on first-line therapy. Now, what we did notice as a result in the enzalutamide trial was the patients who did best were treated in the first or second line setting with the anti-androgen. And again, not unlike what we see in ER-positive breast cancer. Using this endocrine approach early on may be the right place for it. And ultimately, there will be trials opening up shortly exploring the feasibility of adjuvant therapy with enzalutamide for AR-positive, triple-negative breast cancer following standard of care adjuvant therapy.
That sounds interesting. So this scenario of triple-negative disease where either chemotherapy has already been used or in this case the patient really wanted to avoid chemotherapy, is it reasonable to consider an anti-androgen outside a clinical trial? I've had people say, could we use bicalutamide? It's cheaper. Should they get some kind of androgen testing? Should they get some kind of genomic profiling? What would you say to a doc in practice?
Oh, I think it's a challenging situation. So as I said, there is not a standard diagnostic test just yet for AR. There's not even an agreed upon assay, but it is true our pathologists are able to do this using methodology they have in prostate cancer. So I'm finding women who have had their androgen receptor tested in the community and come seeking out investigational trials. You're right, bicalutamide is inexpensive and it's available. And so it's hard to endorse going ahead and using it off label, but we do have now two phase two studies that suggest activity to an anti-androgen. So is it out there? Is it well tolerated? Absolutely. I think we're just not great at figuring out which patients are going to be the best and derive the greatest benefit from this approach.
So I'm curious how you would have approached this patient if she didn't have AR receptors. What would you have been thinking about in terms of systemic treatment first line?
So first line for triple negative breast cancer, in the absence of a BRCA mutation, we have data from the TNT trial that Andy Tutt presented showing that first line taxane had really essentially similar responses to first line platinum in terms of overall response and in terms of progression-free survival. So for all-comer triple-negative breast cancer, first-line taxane is just as good and a good standard compared to first-line carboplatin. For the subset of patients in that trial that were BRCA positive with triple-negative breast cancer, there was a superiority to carboplatin with higher response rate and improved progression-free survival. So often my first-line choice for a patient with triple-negative breast cancer is dictated by what their BRCA mutation status is. In this patient, given her reluctance to chemotherapy and her past experience, I think it would be a negotiation, but I would consider trying first-line capecitabine just for the opportunity to try to get her a cytotoxic therapy. We, in subsequent lines, have evidence for using eribulin. The 301 trial that Peter Kaufman presented compared eribulin to capecitabine, first or second line setting. And for the overall study population, they appeared pretty equivalent. However, in the subset of patients with triple negative breast cancer, eribulin appeared to do better than capecitabine.
And, you know, what's your take in terms of tolerability of eribulin, particularly earlier on? A lot of the usage has been later on, which is, you know, not that easy, particularly in terms of counts and neuropathy. But, for example, on a patient like this, what would you have anticipated the kind of toxicity you would see? And how do you think it would have compared to, say, paclitaxel?
I think eribulin is well tolerated. The main issues you've touched upon already are neutropenia and then neuropathy. So we don't have head-to-head data. The EMBRACE trial was comparing eribulin to treatment of physician's choice, but we didn't have statistical power or the ability to compare eribulin to each of those drugs within treatment of physician's choice. So I can't speak to that with data from a good randomized prospective phase 3 trial. However, in practice, I think in earlier lines, I see less of a problem with neutropenia up front. We're able to manage neutropenia with dose reductions and with growth factor support. So it is a reasonable option, but I have no idea how it compares directly to paclitaxel as a first-line therapy in terms of efficacy.
What about the patient? Now, this lady basically really didn't have adjuvant therapy, but more commonly, a patient's had an anthracycline and taxane. How do you approach those patients, particularly those who have early relapse?
So you're right. In the adjuvant setting, we tend to use our high-risk regimens for triple-negative breast cancer, anthracycline and taxane-based. And we may even be seeing now a bit more platinum use in the neoadjuvant setting as a result of the GEPAR-6TO trial and CLGB, where the addition of carboplatin improved pathologic complete response rates for women with triple-negative breast cancer. So that complicates first-line therapy choice. For a very short disease-free interval, I may be less likely to recycle weekly paclitaxel if someone had a recurrence just on the heels of their adjuvant therapy. And I might be more inclined in that setting to think about a platinum first-line or to really be thinking clinical trials as early as possible. We clearly, even with our best available cytotoxic therapies, are sort of failing these patients with short survival. But recent paclitaxel or taxane in the adjuvant setting, it might help me to lean a little bit more towards carboplatin or cisplatin as monotherapy.
In terms of choice of taxane, I'm curious what your thoughts, first of all, in general, of nab-paclitaxel as opposed to, say, paclitaxel in general and specifically related to triple-negative disease. We saw at the last San Antonio meeting, I thought it was kind of a surprising neoadjuvant trial comparing NAB to paclitaxel. Seems like there was a greater benefit with the NAB. What were your thoughts about that study and in general about NAB?
Yeah, I think the timing, it's great timing for that question because in the JCO, we have Hope Rugo's paper from the CLGB trial, which looked at first-line weekly paclitaxel up against nab-paclitaxel up against ixabepalone. And for all comers, this was a non-inferiority study. Nab-paclitaxel was not inferior to weekly paclitaxel. And actually, ixabepalone appeared inferior. Forgive the double negatives, but it was not non-inferior. So I think there's really not a role for ixabepalone. Nab-paclitaxel and weekly paclitaxel, I think for most, weekly paclitaxel is very reasonable as an option. It is really a tried and true first-line therapy. The advantage with nab-paclitaxel is being able to get away from the concurrent steroid use, and that's meaningful for some of our patients with great sensitivity to the steroids. In the subset of patients on that trial with triple-negative breast cancer, the results reflected the parent population. Again, nab-paclitaxel, non-inferior to weekly paclitaxel, and ixabepalone appearing really not an optimal choice.
So you alluded a little bit to the issue of BRCA mutations and how that affects your algorithm or use of platinums, for example. What's your algorithm for BRCA testing in a patient with metastatic disease, particularly triple negative?
I follow NCCN guidelines in approaching any woman under 60 years of age with a diagnosis of triple negative breast cancer. I refer them for clinical genetic counseling and then subsequently likely testing, because there is an association between BRCA1 and triple negative breast cancer. There's clearly meaning for the patient in treatment choices, and then obviously implications for family members that we just do not want to miss the opportunity to highlight.
So I guess the reason for the age limit is just statistically it's less likely, because, I mean, this lady here, it seems like, you know, even though she's over 65, she's 75 years old, that, you know, maybe it would be nice to know in terms of treatment options.
Right. So great point. So it is less likely that she has a hereditary predisposition to developing this triple negative breast cancer. She did not have a family history. Personally, she did not have a prior history of a contralateral breast cancer or gynecologic malignancy. So it's very unlikely. There is a thought that even in the absence of hereditary BRCA mutations, that there can still be defects in BRCA within the tumor itself that may make it vulnerable to platinums. And a huge research area of investigation is trying to develop other markers to predict for platinum sensitivity or sensitivity, say, to PARP inhibition. There's a homologous recombination deficiency assay, the HRD score, that is, you'll find a correlative study in many of the triple negative trials to see if there's that deficiency in homologous recombination to predict sensitivity to a platinum or a PARP inhibition.
And we saw some data on that at ASCO. Do you think that that assay is sort of getting ready for prime time?
I don't think it's there just yet, but there is a wealth of information that's building to suggest that there's a clearer cutoff. What had previously just looked at one component in the assay now is a more comprehensive biomarker where they're looking at three different unique aspects of the tumor to try to predict sensitivity. So I think it is being refined, and we're building more data to see if that can be used as a predictor.
I guess that's sort of part of what I've heard in the past called BRCA-ness. And right. We hear that talked a lot about in ovarian cancer, where it kind of seems like there's a lot more BRCA-ness in the non-BRCA germline patients. Is that your take compared to triple negative disease? Or do you think there are a lot of people without germline BRCA mutations who have, you know, BRCA-like tumors that are triple negative?
Well, I think something that gave me pause was data with olaparib, one of the PARP inhibitors, seemed very encouraging in BRCA-associated breast cancer. As monotherapy, we were seeing great responses even in pretreated patients, and that's moving on, and there's a large phase 3 trial going on for olaparib with BRCA-associated cancer. But, you know, Dr. Gelman presented data for not BRCA-associated triple-negative breast cancer, and it was lacking in responses. So that's given me some pause that even in theory, there's a BRCA-ness. Haven't seen that pan out in the clinical trials just yet.
One other question, that, you know, it seems particularly with triple-negative disease that we get to a situation where you run out of options a lot sooner than with ER-positive or HER2-positive disease. And this is a question that we hear in every type of cancer. What about next generation sequencing for practical purposes? There are assays out there. Foundation One is one that a lot of people use. Does that ever, or how often is that helpful, for example, in an advanced triple negative disease, or does it just complicate matters?
Great question. So I'm a big supporter of pursuing next generation sequencing in my patients with triple negative breast cancer. I don't know necessarily that treatment decisions based on a next gen sequencing profile are going to be better. That is an assumption, I think, that many of us have, but we would like to think that it will help us to make rational choices about perhaps selecting one clinical trial over another. So I do pursue next gen sequencing quite a bit. I do it through a clinical trial mechanism that I have at my home institution, but as you mentioned, there are commercial assays out there. We just don't know how one assay compares to another. We don't yet know that presence of a particular mutation seen on a report will predict for response to a therapy that's directed to that signaling pathway, but it's hypothesis generating, and I think that the science is almost ahead of where the data is to help us in making these decisions. You say, how useful are the reports? So often I'll see P53 mutations, but it's not something actionable. Occasionally I'll see mutations in AKT, mTOR pathway, and EGFR, and try to explore clinical trials that may be of benefit.
So one other question. We were talking before about olaparib, and you were mentioning the responses that have been seen with patients with BRCA germline mutations. What about veliparib? That's another PARP inhibitor we've heard a fair amount about. It's kind of hard for me to differentiate the two. Maybe you can do that.
Right. So veliparib showed encouraging data in combination with platinum and taxane in the I-SPY trial. And that trial is a neat mechanism to test new drugs in the neoadjuvant setting to try to get a good statistical estimate on which one is worth promoting forward to further development. So veliparib with platinum and taxane was quite encouraging in that setting. And there's actually a large prospective study going on right now, randomizing patients to taxane platinum plus minus the PARP inhibitor. So I think it also is quite far along in development. I don't know necessarily how it directly compares to olaparib. I don't have any sense that one is superior to another at this point. And so I think it's also worthy of just further discovery and development and testing in this setting.
So I want to ask you a couple of questions related to supportive care in the adjuvant setting, beginning with the data presented at ASCO by Hope Rugo et al. On the use of an ice cap to prevent alopecia.
So that recent data actually was inspiring to suggest that maybe with certain regimens, like a taxane, probably anthracycline-sparing regimen, that there is what appears to be success, not universal, but could be as high as, across the literature, as high as 50% in alleviating alopecia to the degree that women can go without a wig. I mean, each of the trials that have been out there have had different primary endpoints, but it's a building group of data that suggests that there may be some benefit. Now, the downside is that it is quite laborious and challenging to wear these caps. It requires multiple caps in one of the systems that we've used. The burden is largely on the patient in bringing this dry ice and coolers and having professional cappers to use this mechanism. But for those who alopecia is a real obstacle, even for some for choosing therapy, I think that it's a reasonable attempt for them.
Any concerns at all about, you know, anti-tumor issues, you know, scalp mets or whatever?
That's been the theoretical concern, I think, for a long time. But when you look at the literature that's available, it is exceedingly uncommon for there to be a scalp met as the sole site of metastatic disease. Scalp mets in general are quite uncommon, but that is rare as the only site of a metastatic recurrence.
So do you kind of routinely bring this up with non-anthracycline adjuvant therapy?
So this is a practice change really over the past couple of months for us since ASCO, but we do make our adjuvant patients aware of the availability. We give them written educational materials to look into this and have the resources available that if a woman would like to pursue that sort of cold cap strategy, that we have that mechanism in place.
It was one of the few trials that really, to me, was impressive was the photographs they showed.
Right.
You know, it's one thing to see numbers, but you see people and you go, oh, well, hey, they've got their hair.
Right.